This week, we welcome Chase Robertson, CEO at Robertson Wealth Management, to discuss the current state of the financial markets. In our second segment, we'll review the Security Weekly 25 Index and all the financial updates for both the public and private security markets. Business Security Weekly starts now.
This is Security Weekly, for security professionals by security professionals. Broadcasting live from G-Unit Studios in Rhode Island, it's the show where we explore the business of security to improve the security of business. Your trusted source for actionable insights on leadership, communication, and innovation. Get ready for Business Security Week. You know what the biggest cyber risk is for your organization? It's the browser, and your users are in it all the time. Every time a link is clicked, untrusted web code enters your network and runs on your machine, exposing you to risk. What if users had full access to the web but never touched web code? You'd have all the benefit of the web and none of the risk. That's why Authenticate built Silo. It's a browser built in the cloud that runs all web content in a remote, isolated browser that never touches your network or device. With a simple click, your organization is fully protected from all web exploits. Find out more at securityweekly.com/authenticate. That's authentic number 8.
Welcome to Business Security Weekly. This is episode number 159, recorded January 20th, 2020. It's Martin Luther King Day and our quarterly Security Money Show, but that means we're also missing Paul. I am your host, Matt Alderman, here in Colorado, joined by my co-host, Mr. Jason Albuquerque, also remote today.
Happy Monday, Matt.
Happy Monday. Well, we did get some interesting football games, you know, the national championship since the last time we met. Great game. Loved the outcome of that game. And, you know, yesterday's games in the, on the pro side were definitely interesting. I was rooting for the Titans, though. I wanted to see if they could knock off the Chiefs.
Yeah, I was rooting for the Titans as well. You know, the definitely want to support the Patriots, you know, the ex-Patriots that are on these teams. So I'm going Jimmy G in the Super Bowl.
There you go. Yeah, you have to. And look, when I saw Garoppolo in preseason against my Broncos, I was like, oh my God, this is going to be a horrible season. Here they are in the Super Bowl. It's been an amazing season to watch them.
Absolutely. Yep. Good luck to them.
Yes. Okay, it's time to attend RSA Conference 2020, February 24th to the 28th, and join thousands of security professionals, forward-thinking innovators, and solution providers for 5 days of actionable learning, inspiring conversation, and breakthrough ideas. If you register before January 24th, that's this Friday, you save $900 on a full conference pass. You can also save an extra $150 with our discount code. Visit securityweekly.com/RSAC2020 to register. We will also be recording in Broadcast Alley at RSA Conference. So please visit that same landing page, securityweekly.com/RSAC2020, to book your micro interview or sponsor one of our enterprise shows, which we'll be recording from the conference. All right, let's get into our guest introduction. Chase Robertson has over 12 years of experience in investments, private equity, investment banking, and corporate banking. Prior to assuming the CEO position at Robertson Wealth Management, Chase served as managing director of Robertson Global Credit and a principal and co-head of energy at Industrial Capital, whose clients include Texas Teacher Retirement System, the City of Chicago, the State of Vermont, sovereign governments, and other families globally. Prior to Industry Capital, Chase was a senior officer at Iberia Bank, which is a publicly traded Louisiana-based bank. Chase, welcome to Business Security Weekly.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks for having me today.
So I need to start with the story of how we met. Some people have heard parts of the story, but not your part. Last year, my son decided he wanted to attend high school at the Air Force Academy. There's a public high school at the Air Force Academy. And I used to have to drive him a half an hour down to the Air Force Academy, drop him off, and then drive home. And it just happened to be during the radio show. So Chase has a radio show called Straight Talk Money. And it just happened to be part of that commute. And I just listened to you and Peggy. And I'm like, I've got to meet you. I want to learn more about what you guys do at Robertson Wealth Management. And that's why I reached out to you way back in the day. So give people a little background, because your background's very interesting, but this radio show thing is also kind of fun too.
Yeah. So I spent the majority of my career working on Wall Street. And then, you know, an unusual opportunity was presented to me at the end of 2016. My late father, the founder of Roberts Wealth Management, founded in 1976, passed away. Either way, I had to move back to Houston to take care of my father's affairs. But part of that was assuming control of a company that this had been our succession plan for a long time. It was just a little bit earlier than expected. So, you know, me and my family moved from San Francisco, where I was head of Industry Capital's energy group, took over Roberts Wealth Management, which is one of the first family offices found in the late 70s. Fast forward till now, we manage money for about 3,500 families globally. And one of the things that really sets us apart is that, you know, the majority of our strategies are proprietary, meaning my CFAs, my PhDs, you know, including me, our investment committee pick the stocks. It's not a one-shop stop where you just get thrown into BlackRock or Blackstone's, you know, ETFs. Not that that's a bad way to do it, but this is a little bit more customized. And then another thing that really sets us apart, or I think makes us a little bit different, is we have the radio show. Initially a TV show back in the day, fast forward till about 8 years ago, turned into radio, nationally syndicated, about 1.3 million daily listeners. So our new market's Portland. But oddly enough, and it's yielded some phenomenal relationships with the firm, Denver is our booming market. That's where we're getting not only the best new clients, but just a flood of people that are looking for the family office services, the investment management services, and the financial advisory to either get to the retirement or have the cash flow in their retirement that they need to pay their bills. So,
and I'm curious, is that because you know we've seen a lot of influx into Colorado from the oil and gas side, right? Sure. We've seen a lot of people from Texas with the oil and gas here and the shale oil come in. Is it because of that and people kind of know the Robertson name, or is it people outside of oil and gas too? I'm just curious.
I think that's actually a really good question. So I think in the oil world, we're a well-known financial advisor, because we not only advise individual, we advise companies on drilling and analysis, financial analysis. We're a financial advisor to oil companies also. Energy is a big space of ours. So I think that's part of it. I also think, you know, just analyzing this thought process, you know, we have a great person on before us and after us in Denver. And it's the right time. It's also the most listened to conservative station. And I think that kind of formula leads to, you know, getting us to about half our listener base. Now, I say that the last time I was in Denver doing prospect meetings, the average person drove over 4 hours to come meet with us. I don't know if that's, just how spread out Denver's grown and boomed. But, you know, we're talking as far as Cheyenne, Wyoming, Estes Park, Colorado. I mean, the station really reaches far there. But you know, for years we drove in business from New York City, San Francisco, California, New Orleans, and now it's, you know, Denver, New Orleans, and Houston are kind of leading the pack. So, you know, it's great because, you know, those are places where people have great personalities. You know, financial advisory is a relationship. It's a long-term relationship, and, you know, having great clients that, you know, that like your investment strategies and like what you do and like what you do for them, you know, makes my job and our job here that much more enjoyable. So it's been a great fit for us. And, you know, the state of Colorado has been real good to us Texas boys down here.
So. Yeah. We like when you come in here, we always have fun seeing you.
Yeah.
So give the audience kind of a overview of the market. We've seen the market go on an interesting tear over the past few weeks, right? We resolved some issues with China from a trade perspective. We're really seeing the markets click up here. Kind of give us an overview of what's going on in the market and kind of what's driving this market. And then we'll talk about, you know, what slows it down, and then we can talk some submarkets.
Absolutely. So, you know, the key thing, you know, when you look at the market is, and Matt made a good point, you need to know what takes it up and you need to know what takes it down. You're going to be a good investor. And I like to break that into 5 points. So that's valuation, momentum, fundamental, psychology, and liquidity. I think right now psychology is leading the pack. People want to be in the market. you know, a popular phrase from this generation. I technically fit into it, but I do not believe I am a millennial. I think I'm right on the year. Is FOMO, fear of missing out. I use the term FWOM. We made that up here. Fun without me. But at the end of the day, people want to be in the market right now. And it's not a, I mean, it's a good place to be. It's done phenomenally. There's great liquidity in the market. There's great momentum. Earnings are slowing. Stocks are expensive. There are some value to be found. You know, we run ultra value portfolios here that, you know, we buy things on sale. But, you know, one thing I note on the show on a regular basis, Matt, when we look at valuation, you know, I have clients that won't overpay for a bottle of water, but right now they want to overpay for stocks. And that usually leads to some problems when people will just blindly put their capital to work with no appreciation for the real risks on the table, the concentration in their portfolios and how it fits into their balance sheet. You know, equity exposure is one thing, but overpaying historically does not lead to the investment returns that you want. We are institutional investors that focus, you know, we're almost crazy about not overpaying for stocks. We want it. It doesn't matter if it's the greatest trend ever. We refuse to overpay from a valuation standpoint. And that's kept us out of a lot of trouble. As you know, you make your money on the buy, you don't make your money on the sell. So, you know, we're looking at valuation, tremendous momentum from people thinking that they're going to miss out. You know, fundamentals are good. When we look at valuation from a price earnings standpoint, you know, I immediately go to cheap money, where the Fed has kept the interest rates, if they stay where they are, the valuations, let's just use the Dow 30 stocks, are very appropriate. If interest rates bounce upwards, you know, those valuations aren't going to hold, but for now they're within a good range. We touched on psychology, and then, you know, momentum and liquidity are kind of the same thing. Just there is a ton of liquidity. You know, I like to use Boeing as an example. I mean, for every buyer, I mean, Boeing has a ton of headline risk. They have $20 billion in liquidity. They tapped half of it today. But at the end of the day, from every buyer, there is a seller of Boeing stock, and that's why you haven't seen it pull back the way it's been expected. Mm-hmm. So those are just some examples. But those are the 5 points that are driving the market. We expect the market to climb 6 to 12% this next year. We expect earnings to deteriorate between 5 and 10% bottom line, just from this, the economy slowing. Impacts of the trade resolution, even though, you know, the tariffs haven't come out, we still see that. And then the impact of commodity prices and other cyclical and geopolitical events, we think will erode earnings just a little bit.
So, Chase, if you could just follow up on one of the things you had mentioned about kind of that knee-jerk reaction to buy, right? Is it because we're in this healthy labor market where, you know, I mean, retail sales are strong, housing market's strong? Is it just that simple fear of I don't want to miss out? Is that why you're seeing that knee-jerk reaction?
We think so. I mean, you know, whenever we write an investment thesis, you know, myself and my investment team, you know, it's usually a 100 to 150 page document on why we're buying a stock, why we want to sit on it. And a lot of those stocks that we bought 3, 4, 5 years ago, and somebody asked me this past week, and just gives you an idea. My oldest position dates back to the 70s. So I, and some of our ultra long portfolios, that's how long of an investor we are. Mm. But you know, as we look at, you know, people just wanting to get in, and the way we approach, you know, our investment thesis, you know, we buy at the right price, we watch it, you know, we watch it materialize. And then at a certain point, you know, if we've collected the upside and the dividends that we expected, if let's say you had 200 shares of stock in your account, we might sell 100 and curve them back. Mm-hmm. But we absolutely are not going to go back in, if we're back to kind of your question, and just buy more and more and more because, you know, we think this is going to go on forever. I mean, we, between all of us, the oldest partner, Roberts Wealth Management, just turned 75. I'm 36, you know, between all of us, it's over 300 years of investment experience, probably significantly more than that. It's very important to recognize that people are just buying for no reason. I mean, let's talk about two stocks that overlap what, you know, you guys like to talk about. Apple, you know, Apple has historically been cheap. It's Buffett's number one pick, but it's had a great run. You know, it's one of the most shorted stocks in the FANG group right now. last 90 days. It's practically doubled. Tesla's doubled in the last 90 days. Most shorted stock on Earth. So, you know, these, I think the other thing to really think about, and not to jump around here too much, is that, you know, we all know that equity values don't grow at these speeds. You're seeing the liquidity premium grow. And that's where I like to remind people is that, you know, trading's very different now. You know, it used to be 5 days before you even knew you owned a stock, you instantaneously own it and you can turn around and flip it. When the liquidity premium compresses and you throw algorithmic trading on top of it, I mean, we have an algorithm that rerun after 350 points down or up, our algorithm just goes crazy. You know, you throw those into, you might see some intense volatility in this election season. So I continue to remind our clients, our friends and our listeners that, you know, being diversified across multiple asset classes is very important. And why we're touching on volatility, if you don't see the market pull back in the next 2 weeks, you're going to see a lot of short sellers in February get squeezed and the market is just going to jockey, you know, to heights we've never seen before. So it's interesting times. It's fun time. It's a fun time to be an investor. This is also one of those times where you don't want to make a lot of structural changes to your portfolio.
Yeah. You always talked about, kind of Q1 2020 being, yep, you know, last year, kind of this point in time where we could see some good growth into Q1 2020. Beyond, yep, that though, things got a little cloudier. You are seeing a slowdown in earnings growth. I've seen some of it as well in the Security Weekly 25 index that I track. So we're seeing some of that happen. Is that what slows the market down? Or, you know, once we get into summer, now we're into the election season, right? And the election season can, yep, always do some interesting things with the market. So what happens beyond Q1, maybe up into like October, a month before the election? Do we go, sure, sideways for a while?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to see some enhanced volatility. You know, it really goes back to, you know, the question your colleague just asked, is that, you know, and I kind of noted it on my Boeing point, is that when does the buyer for every seller and vice versa go away? You know, when does the average investor say, hey, you know, this is too expensive. I need to take some profits. You know, I need to sell half my stocks and rotate, you know, back into fixed income. This isn't right for me. I'm taking too much risk. You know, all the talking heads have a date, and I picked Q1 2020 5 years ago. I thought that would be at a point where we all really agree that the expansion is going to slow down with the election cycle. I thought, and this has always been my prediction, whether I'm right or wrong, people would take some chips off the table. It's been a phenomenal run for the last 11, 12 years. And, you know, at a certain point, this absolutely doesn't end. But I think flat, you know, one thing that many of us hadn't and didn't take into consideration 10 years ago when we wrote those investment theses in you know, the 2010 range, was none of us had expected there to be basically free money. I mean, if you have a good credit score, you can basically borrow less inflation rate or less the investment risk rate, which is, you know, relatively 2%, you can basically borrow for nothing. I mean, I still can 12 years later, call my bank and borrow for 3.25% unsecured. And I can do it in 24 hours. I mean, I'm not specifically this massive powerhouse with this, you know, a Boeing like balance sheet, but money is basically still free. None of us really expected that in the investment world because, you know, let's be honest, the cost of capital 30 years out should be more expensive than the cost of capital now. You know, and that was the big conversation last year, was the inverted yield curve, a yield curve that looks more like a rainbow instead of a doorstop. And, you know, these are all things that nobody really expected to do or see that are still weighing on the market. Fortunately enough, it's very positive. But when that changes, you know, those are some real concerns that we have, because at the end of the day, our clients come to us to protect their principal. And that's the first thing we start with any investment we make.
Got it. So I want to switch gears a little bit because I want to talk about the cybersecurity market, right? A market, sure, that this audience listens to. You know, I track the top 25 pure plays in the space. I also, sure, look at, I see a lot of startups. We see a lot of funding announcements. What's your take on the market, right? It's an interesting submarket that sits kind of under the NASDAQ, right? Most of these are tech companies.
Yep.
Thoughts, because you were an early investor in CrowdStrike, I believe. I think you were part of the IPO for CrowdStrike. So just curious, your investment thesis on CrowdStrike and the market as a whole. And then I want to play a couple what-if scenarios with you.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, we are notoriously a, you know, real estate, consumer good, energy focus group. I mean, our research is usually around energy. Understandable because the majority of our clients, you know, Denver, Houston, New Orleans, you know, these are folks that work at energy companies. I always, you know, by geographic location, we're an energy shop. But, you know, as we grow, as we have much younger clients that are coming on board, that aren't so focused on giving dividends from their portfolio to live on. You know, we've really diversified in some asset classes that historically we hadn't really participated in to add value and alpha to our clients. You know, we at Robertson Wealth Management and in the finance business, you know, we call it FinTech. You know, it's becoming a major expense for us. I was thinking about this story just to tell everybody. When I first started in my career, I was a professional trader. I started as an analyst, but I quickly became a professional trader. I used to have to log into my computer, log into my Bloomberg, and I'd need this finger, and I was done. I could trade directly to the ARCA to the floor. Fast forward till now, I need over 12 different passwords and prompts, and I need more than just this finger. I need this finger too to get all the way to the same access that I had back in 2006. So that gives you an idea, and yes, I absolutely write those passwords down on a piece of paper underneath my keypad because there's too many to remember. And you know, the way we protect our client data, it has grown significantly. I mean, for a long time, you know, it was fireproof safes in locked rooms with security cameras. You know, now we have, you know, cloud and that really led us to our thought process in CrowdStrike and the whole sector. You know, the sector is growing. The way we look at it is there is an unlimited need for it. It's fascinating. It's interesting. And from an investment standpoint, what makes it so interesting is the cloud space and the fact that that is majority, in our opinion, contracted cash flow. You know, we were early investors in CrowdStrike. You know, this last batch of IPOs haven't been fantastic. It was kind of a funny group. I think Uber should have IPO'd much earlier than it did. I think that threw a lot of the group off. And a lot of these IPOs via the structures they came for were more liquidity events than raises. But, you know, we can stay on CrowdStrike. You know, that is now becoming a pretty good investment. I mean, we're pre-IPO, so it's, you know, we're up. But we're, you know, to answer your question more directly, Matt, you know, we're continuing to add these to portfolios. And we think to be diversified and catch the alpha that you really desire to get to retirement, we'll just frame it there. You know, these have to be part of your portfolio. Where 10 and 15 years ago, we didn't feel that way. And a lot of asset managers, you know, they didn't look there, you know, to get the alpha that their clients desired.
Yeah, one of the challenges, yeah, no, it does. But here's one of the challenges I have with the space. You really don't get a dividend return out of these investments. And we see that in some of the tech companies in general. But if you go through, there's only like three or four of these companies that pay a dividend, right? So they don't fit into a dividend portfolio. Nope. So does that disincentivize investors like you to invest in the space because you can't get a dividend return on some of these investments?
Well, I you know, that's a really good question. I think the first way to look at that, and it's 100% why Apple pays a dividend, is that certain mandates require a dividend. You know, to be in our ultra long dividend growth portfolio or that fund, that goes back to the 70s. I mean, you have to pay a dividend. It has to be trackable, and you have to have, you know, the cash to cover it. So yes, it does. It especially for Matt. You know, clients that are coming to us, they've just retired or they're about to retire and they need money off their account to live or at least live the retirement that they desire. You know, that's a common ask for us. People come from all over the world for our income portfolio. So yeah, that keeps it out of it. It's one of the things I was mentioning. We're getting a lot of younger people that are coming to us, not people that are just ready to jump into retirement and say, hey, you know, I want to start preparing now. You know, the CrowdStrike, you know, some of the, we had talked about, I know Booz Allen is in a pure play, as you discussed, but that, you know, we have some friends that work there. So we've been using stocks like that, but you know, they're going into portfolios, but you're absolutely right. They're going to be kept out of dividend portfolios. So it would be fortuitous for these companies to slow down their compounding annual growth rate by not reinvesting so much. And at least, you know, even if you pay a 1% dividend, that's enough to get you into mutual funds, ETFs, and wealth manager funds that require a dividend.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons why I don't have a lot of these investments, because I look at the dividend number. I also look at the PE ratios and a bunch of other things.
100%. You go back to 1929, market has returned average to 5 to 7%. I'm rounding those up and down. Almost half of that's dividend.
Interesting. So the other play I want to make off of this quickly is, okay, we get through Q1, we start to go sideways, we get a lot of volatility. If we start to see some contraction in the market, what does that do to the private side of this fence, right? Investments, because we've got a number of startups coming through their pipelines, right? Series A, mm-hmm. Series B, some all the way up to Series E. If the markets start to slow down and contract a little bit, does that also put pressure on some of the private funds as well to continue to fuel some of these startups?
I think the real net impact is how the valuation deck will reset. We look at a lot of what ends up being a pre-IPO play. You know, a lot of times, you know, we're looking, you know, we'll run a valuation exercise. They'll have gotten a fairness opinion from an investment bank, and then other family offices that we like to co-invest with. You know, each one of us have done our homework. We'll kind of share our thoughts and kind of a joint thesis and get there. But yeah, if we see a big contraction in the market, you know, we're going to want to, from our side of the fence, are going to look for that valuation deck to reset down. So we're coming in at a smaller entry point. So yeah, it'll have some difficulty in the market. I mean, tech is still though super strong, and you know, really good portfolio managers will take profits when the time is right. So a lot of money will have been made, and then a lot of money will have to, you know, come back out. On the other side of your question, there's still a ton of capital sitting on the sidelines. You know, I ran a large energy group in San Francisco. We were one of the few shops out there, though the base of that company was tech and real estate. But that allowed me and my team access to see what other really good tech investing firms were doing. You know, investment is a small space. You know, there's just a ton of money on the sidelines. And I think for this space, it's unlimited. You know, it kind of fits in the data center. You know, this stuff just, I mean, people want it, especially behind high quality management teams that can deliver results.
That's good news for the industry. Jason, I've consumed this entire interview. I'm sorry. Any questions for Chase?
No, I mean, I did have one question on manufacturing, right? I mean, manufacturing's really been in a lull. What are you forecasting out for manufacturing? And what role does that play in forecasting the future of the economy for at least 2020?
Yeah, so depends on what aspect you're looking at. I mean, we are looking at manufacturing to slow just purely on a demand standpoint. We're looking very closely at how commodities, not necessarily oil, impact manufacturing. We've been looking at, if you want to dig in kind of some of the odd places that we specifically look, you know, we'll look at the amount of used cars on the market. We'll look at builders. We'll, like everybody else, we'll look at the widgets. But I think for this next year, manufacturing isn't an issue. I think the real issue globally with manufacturing is that China, you know, we got the results on China's economy last week for 19. The Chinese economy has slowed to a point, the slowest point it has for the last 30 years. That's a pure demand standpoint, where I think a lot of investment managers are wrong and a lot of economists. I'm not an economist. I'm purely an investment guy. Is that you know, people are predicting, you know, India being a huge, Africa being a huge consumer, you know, having spent a lot of time in Lagos, Nigeria, and living in those parts of the world. Yeah, there are a lot of people there, but they can barely afford to eat, more or less consume, you know, those goods and services that people think they're going to eventually buy into. So I think until on that point, until the wage and wealth gap tightens up a little bit, you know, those consumer channels are off the table. So I think we're really looking to China and America. Though on the flip side, you know, leaving manufacturing to the side for a second and just going into consumers consuming things, you know, times are good right now. So I mean, we are consuming mass amounts of things that we wouldn't necessarily you know, have purchased, which is good for us here domestically. I hope I answered your question.
Yes. Excellent. Thank you. Yeah.
Are you good, Jason? Because I love having these kind of conversations. It's so much fun. Chase, thank you so much for joining us on Business Security Weekly.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you. We'll take a quick break, and then we'll cover the Security Weekly 25 Index updates then.
With over half of enterprise security budgets going towards detection and response in 2020, the challenge is investing in solutions that can scale, migrate, and adapt with your business. Cloud-native security solutions from ExtraHop are purpose-built to help your team respond to threats across the hybrid attack surface. Everywhere your enterprise exists today and wherever it goes tomorrow, ExtraHop is there to secure it. Learn more at securityweekly.com/ExtraHop. The question is simple. Have any of the systems on my network been compromised? The answer is harder than it should be. Enter AI Hunter. Active Countermeasures has automated and streamlined techniques used by the best pen testers and threat hunters in the industry to create AI Hunter, a network threat hunting solution that does the first pass of a hunt for you to identify systems that are most likely to be compromised and scores the results on a scale from 0 to 100. You can then research those systems in depth with AI Hunter. Focus your valuable time on the systems that need your expertise with AI Hunter. Sign up for a personal demo today at securityweekly.com/ACM.
Welcome back to Business Security Weekly. I am your host, Matt Alderman, joined by Jason Albuquerque. Join us at InfoSec World 2020, March 30th to April 1st at the Disney Contemporary Resort. Security Weekly listeners save 15% off the InfoSec World main conference or World Pass. Visit securityweekly.com/ISW2020 and click the register button to register with our discount code. Also, our next webcast is February 13th with Sri Sundaralingam, Vice President, Product and Solutions Marketing at ExtraHop, where we will discuss cloud-native network detection and response. Register for our upcoming webcast by visiting securityweekly.com. Select the webcast drop-down from the top menu and click registration. It's also how you get to all of our on-demand content as well. We did a lot of webcasts last year. We're also going to augment some of this with some technical virtual trainings. So this is going to be an exciting year for us on those webcasts and training pages. All right, Jason, let's get into my Security Weekly 25 Index. So most listeners know, once a quarter, I get to go update all the financials for these top 25 companies. And it usually takes me a few hours to go pull the analyst reports and update all the data, and then I summarize it beautifully for you and Paul, except for Paul's off today.
So the work you do is great. It teaches me every time. I learn a lot.
It's a lot of fun to see how our industry does as a whole. And so it also forces you to stay kind of up to date with all the things that are changing, right? So when Symantec got bought by Broadcom, Symantec changes ticker signal symbol to NLOK. For Norton LifeLock.
Right.
Same stock, though, and still in the index because it's still kind of a pure play cybersecurity company. At some point, it may come out if we get a really nice other company to come in and replace it. But I kept it in the portfolio, just had to do the symbol update. But if you weren't tracking this, you wouldn't know that the symbol changed.
Yeah, no, agreed. And it's really goodbye to the consumer brand of Symantec, right? I mean, now, you know, Broadcom kind of took over the enterprise side. And, you know, this is really, really its own standalone, right? And as a alum of Symantec, you know, I was on the enterprise side. The consumer side was kind of the enemy anyway.
That was always my biggest it was my biggest complaint with Symantec. They didn't know what they wanted to be when they grew up. Did they want to be an enterprise security company or a consumer security company? Broadcom buys the enterprise business. They convert themselves into a consumer security play. At least they know what they want to be now when they grow up. So that's good, I think.
Yeah, they have focus. And from what I read, they have, I think they brought over 50 million consumers on the NortonLifeLock side, which is pretty good.
Yeah, and the stock has actually done pretty well. When we get into some of these results, Symantec's, you know, Symantec was kind of down, and they've they've come back under this spin out. Actually, their enterprise products are performing better, so it's crazy. All right, let's talk some numbers. So the index closed at 1,226.33. So I set the index when I created it a year ago at 1,000. So we're up 22.63%. That's actually not bad. If you think about that, that's been, I did this a year ago. So over the last year, this index has grown 22.63%, which I think is a pretty good return. But when you compare it to the, but when you compare it to the NASDAQ, it gets interesting. The NASDAQ closed at 93.88 and 94 on Friday, which is an increase of 41.5%.
Absolutely incredible.
That's just a crazy run. That's why I said the markets have been hot lately. And you see that now a year later, as this is our fifth show on this. Just some tremendous growth in that time frame. 40% return. Oh my gosh, that's amazing for the market.
That's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're still underperforming the NASDAQ as a subsector, by the way, for people, you know, counting at home. Let's see. Revenue beat was 1.79% on average. So we're slow. We see that coming down, right? Chase talked about this in the last segment. We're seeing some slowdown in earnings and revenue growth. And so on the revenue side, we definitely saw that slowdown in the index. On average, it's down from last quarter. Earning beats were up, actually 50.4% on average, which is up from last quarter. So this set of 25 stocks is actually doing a little better from an earnings perspective. And here's my take on this, Jason. A lot of these companies that came out IPO were losing money, right? They come into the market and they have to start to show profitability. And what I think is happening is some of these early IPOs, they didn't know how to judge earnings. And now what you're seeing is some beats from negative earnings to now you got a few of these companies starting to get profitable, and it's throwing some of those calculations off. We'll see over time whether that continues, but I think a lot of it has to do with uncertainty of how to really look at the earnings of some of these early stage companies.
Yeah, that makes sense.
All right. Analyst rating is on average 1.73. It's a weaker buy, almost a hold. That's also down from last quarter. So you're seeing analysts also step back a little bit. It's not a big bump. I mean, it's really, really minuscule. I think we went from like 1.72 to 1.73 or something like that. The lower the number, the better. But you are seeing some analysts maybe back off the market a little bit. Maybe they want to see more profitability out of some of these companies before they rate them. So for example, I think it's Ping Identity that went IPO last year. I don't think any analysts are covering them, at least in my market beat reports, which I used to pull this together. I didn't see any analysts covering them yet.
Okay.
Kind of interesting.
Yeah.
All right. Who did best? So best rated, it shifted this up. You know, we've seen some consistency with the best and the worst over a couple quarters of this. But Verint and CrowdStrike were the best rated by the analysts. We talked CrowdStrike a lot in the last segment with Chase.
I was very surprised with Verint. I mean, they're forecasting, you know, a future range of $58 to $75, right? And right now they're at $58.24, I believe. And the analysts actually came out, you know, and had positive analytics on them, basically giving them that forecast. And you know, they're expected to be about 68.43 in the next 12 months, which is pretty good. You know, that's an upside of 17%+.
Yeah, and there's very few security companies that have a strong buy recommendation. They and CrowdStrike are two of the few that actually have a strong buy rating from an analyst. A lot of them are in the buys and holds, but very few have a strong buy.
Yeah.
And then followed Rapid7 and Mimecast. And Rapid7, again, has shown some consistency here over the last couple quarters of being rated pretty well with good growth.
Yep. Yeah. No, they're doing extremely well, right? I mean, you know, I kind of trend back 6 months, and I mean, they're up from August 2019, right? So where a lot of them were kind of shaky. So I looked at that, and, you know, they're at 6106 in August, last August, and now they're up almost $63, I believe, a share.
Yeah. Been doing pretty well. Rated NetScout, actually, then followed by SecureWorks and Checkpoint. Yeah. So you saw Checkpoint miss on the revenue side, right, which was interesting.
NetScout missed too. I mean, they were down 3.3%, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you've seen a couple misses in the market, right?
Yeah.
And that's why you see the analyst ratings coming down. Best overall performance for the quarter was CrowdStrike, then SailPoint. SailPoint has been here multiple times. Man, they continue to do well on their numbers.
Yeah, I mean, they seem to be up and down, right? I mean, last year at this time, they were at $32. Now they're at $25.43. On my birthday, January 9th, you know, they're at $26.68. So it seems to be up and down, but their forecast is pretty good. I mean, you know, they're forecasting upwards of 37. So.
Yeah. And then, you know, Checkpoint comes into this worst performers list because of the miss, you know, which I thought was interesting. You know, Checkpoint, usually been a pretty good performer. They've made some interesting acquisitions in the last year and a half, really starting to differentiate the portfolio. But what I see here is that the traditional Checkpoint business, the firewall business, is now starting to slow down. And that's why some of these acquisitions have happened.
Yeah, I looked into this a little bit, and Morgan Stanley actually downgraded them. They have a weight category, right? An equal weight to underweight. So they actually went down to the underweight category.
No IPOs in Q4, so nobody's coming into the market. I mean, we still don't really know what's going to happen in 2020. Does Tanium eventually come to the table and try to exit? Who knows? I've had them as a question mark for a year.
Tanium's interesting, right? I mean, yeah, before this, I didn't really know a whole heck of a lot about Tanium. I saw them kind of as an endpoint EDR, But yeah, as I dug in a little bit deeper, they seem pretty interesting, right? So, I mean, you know, they're looking at what, Q4 funding round of $200 million in 2018?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you think they're setting themselves up to go IPO, but yet kind of whispers, nothing yet.
Yeah, I mean, it was about a little over a year ago, right? They got $200 million, so...
Exactly right. We did have a couple big acquisitions out of the public market side.
Yeah.
Sophos got acquired by Thoma Bravo. They are currently still trading, and they are in my index. If they ever come off the London Stock Exchange, I will have to replace them in the index, but currently they're still trading there. And it might be because either Thoma Bravo is going to keep them there or they haven't finished the acquisition, but that was $3.8 billion acquisition in Q4. Yeah.
And big. I mean, something that I found interesting as I dug into this too is that Thoma Bravo actually created a special purpose vehicle called SurfBuyer to make this acquisition, which I found interesting. Is that something you typically see, Matt?
No, I haven't. And you know, Thoma Bravo's bought a lot of security companies in the last year, right? I mean, they are building a portfolio. They've got Imperva, I think they bought Logarithm as well. So, I mean, they are assembling a number of security products in this private equity portfolio. The question is, what are they going to do with them? Do they bring some of these assets together, spin them back out? It'll be interesting to see how this plays out. But they've been very active in buying companies in this space. And then Carbonite, who used to be in the index, Carbonite bought Webroot. This would have been about a year ago. Carbonite was in the index. But after the Webroot acquisition, they really tanked valuation-wise. You know, I try to have $1 billion market cap. And after that acquisition, Carbonite tanked. And then OpenText came in and bought them for $1.4 billion, which interesting acquisition. Don't know how much you know about OpenText techs, but they've done some interesting acquisitions over the past couple of years.
Yeah, I looked at that. Yeah, it seems like they're trying to really bolster up disaster recovery and resilience and things of that nature. That seems where they're trying to kind of you know, strengthen up and really on the SMB consumer side of the aisle.
Yeah. And Carbonite's a great fit, but Webroot had kind of a consumer play, but it's more of a pure play, you know, security endpoint company that's also under Carbonite. Right. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with the Webroot components of that. You know, Webroot was based here in Colorado, up north of Denver. And I haven't talked to some of the guys, and it's been a couple years now after that acquisition to see how things are going. But it'll be interesting, you know, how much of Webroot stuff actually survives in this portfolio.
All right,
let's go to the private side. It's good funding in Q4. So private funding in Q4 was almost $1.54 billion in funding. Some really big rounds. 1Password, which we covered on Enterprise Security Weekly, that was a $200 million Series A. That is a big A round.
Yeah, yeah. And reading into that investment, they plan on kind of, you know, taking that money and really strengthening their go-to-market, right? So getting a global presence as a password manager, password vault.
Riskified took $165 million in a Series A. I had to do some research on these guys. Series E, they're you know, that's pretty far down the path. On the risk management side, that's supposed to be Spark Cognition. That is it's an AI ML company. Took $100 million Series C round.
Yeah, these guys are very interesting, right? I mean, I had to do a little research on them as well. And, you know, not only do they have ML-driven endpoint security, but they're doing deep learning against unstructured data, protection or prediction and learning from sensor data. So they're really getting in deep to the ML side, which I think is very, very interesting.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And again, I would not have known about these two companies if I had not done this segment to go, wait, I never heard of those guys before. I got to go do some research. The other two on this list, I know CoreLight was previously a sponsor. So they took a $50 million Series C, and then Secure Code Warrior. We've talked to those guys. We love what they do. They took a $48 million Series B round in Q4.
Yeah, and I mean, they had some great investors, right? Goldman Sachs, ForgePoint Capital, Cisco Investments. That was pretty amazing when I looked at that.
Yeah. Yeah, some good stuff. Some interesting private acquisitions also. $7 billion in private acquisitions in Q4. The biggest one, Shape Security by F5. That was a $1 billion acquisition, which was interesting. Observe It, again, was a sponsor of, I believe, Pulse Security Weekly. They were acquired by Proofpoint for $225 million in Q4. Aporeto, I know the Aporeto folks a little bit from my days at Layered Insight in the container security space. They were acquired by Palo Alto for $150 million. We covered the Indigy by Tenable. That's their industrial control systems security company. Tenable bought them for $78 million in Q4 to really integrate IT and OT. That's kind of the plan over there on the Tenable side. Kind of roll all that together. And we've seen some interesting moves in the industrial control systems. Forescout bought Security Matters last year. And then we saw, I think there was one more that happened. And then you get the Tenable acquisition of Indigy. So you're seeing some consolidation of some of those industrial control systems coming together. And then CloudFormity was acquired by Trend Micro for $70 million. So, you know, a lot of acquisitions in the private space, $7 billion worth in Q4. That's a lot of money moving around.
Yeah. And I'm thinking there's going to be more and more consolidation, more and more acquisitions coming. It just makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen some interesting plays in certain market segments, right? Mm-hmm. We've seen a lot of moves on the endpoint side. You see, you know, CrowdStrike came public, but Carbon Black got bought by VMware. Endgame got bought by Elastic. So you're seeing definitely some movement in the endpoint markets for sure. There's no doubt about it. Yeah. Symantec acquisition to Broadcom, just a lot of endpoint moves. Mm-hmm. But I've also seen some really interesting things on the cloud and application security side. both Checkpoint and Palo Alto have made some interesting acquisitions. You've got this one from Trend Micro with CloudFormity. You've got another one, the Aporeto by Palo Alto again, and the Shape Security by F5. So you're starting to see some really interesting cloud AppSec plays.
Well, I mean, you know, the traditional manufacturers kind of have to, right? That was why I asked the manufacturing question in the previous segment with Chase, right? Because you're starting to see a lot of the legacy manufacturers now try to get into that subscription game. They have to. They don't have a choice.
Yeah, they don't. Yeah. And they're going to have to augment their portfolios with other capabilities, right? We saw, we see some slowdown from Checkpoint in the firewall space, but they've made a lot of application security plays. They got to get that stuff integrated into the portfolio and hopefully drive that up. Palo Alto's made a ton of acquisitions in that space last year. Yeah, see more of it. Good. A couple hot startups. You know, we see companies come across all the time, so it's always interesting. We see companies that not a lot of people know about sometimes, so Authenticate.
We had them on the show, Yep,
and browser security, where they're actually hosting the browser in the cloud so they can strip out all the dangerous stuff. It doesn't hit your network, doesn't hit your machine. Very interesting technology when we think about all the issues with browsers. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Like them a lot.
Yeah, and then Simulate. I mean, you know, I've actually had the luxury of you know, piloting this platform, and it's actually pretty good. You know, we have it in our lab right now, where you have a proof of concept going with Simulate, and you know, we're able to automate a lot of the breach and attack simulation that our engineers would typically do. So so far so good.
That's great, because you know, that's an up and coming space. One Paul's very interested in. He's done a lot of briefings with the different breach and attack simulation vendors. This is yet another one. So it's good somebody's, you know, testing it out and how it's working. But we've definitely seen it, and it's interesting. And then Psycognito, this is on the bot management side, right? We see a ton of malicious and even good network traffic coming from bots. And so bot management and how you manage bots, both good and malicious, and try to control how network comes into the into your network. It's a very interesting space, and it's kind of this kind of precursor to application and cloud security that people sometimes forget about. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I mean, just you know, doing the research for the show, it's something I'm going to take back and take a deeper look at.
Yeah. So, like I said, we see them every once in a while, so it's interesting to see, you know, how some of these guys do. So I always try to pick out two or three just to talk about. If you're looking for a bot management solution, maybe these guys have something that you're interested in, or an attack and breach simulation. Maybe you want to look at them. Just these are potentially up and comers, and you know, hopefully some of them become sponsors. But you know, hopefully some of them also get funded to continue to drive their solutions in the market. All right. Anything else, Jason, while I got you?
No, good to go. This was a great segment. Like I said, lots of research on this one, and as always, Matt, I learned coming out of these as well. So good to go.
Yeah, it's a great way to learn. So thank you for joining me. Everyone, thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next week on Business Security Weekly.